Hello, this is Matt Woodbury, and I'll be bringing you the first part of the news from the Pantograph today. This is the edition dated Friday, September 22nd, 2017. I'll start with a story just on the first page entitled Three Deaths, A Reminder to Listen, Experts Say, Mental Health Pros, Community Reeling from Traumatic Event, written by Paul Schweich. The time for Central Illinois to listen to others is now. With police saying that a Bloomington man killed his two young sons, set fire to their home, and then killed himself as his wife frantically searched in vain for her family, McLean County mental health professionals said Thursday that people need to know it's okay to seek help from others. This is a traumatic event for the whole community, said Megan Mosier, crisis program manager for the Center for Human Services, McLean County's mental health agency. Everybody in the community is going to be affected by this, agreed Chris Cashin, a licensed clinical professional counselor with OSF Healthcare Behavioral Health. The tragedy not only impacts family members, friends, and co-workers of Eric and Pamela Ringenberg, but may cause anxiety for people affected by suicide, homicide, or other trauma. PATH, or Providing Access to Help, which operates a Twin Cities-based 24/7 crisis information and referral hotline at 211, is getting calls related to Pantograph articles about the tragedy, said Executive Director Karen Zangirl. We need to lean on each other to share our pain because this is hard on all of us, said Colleen O'Connor, prevention specialist with Project Oz and a board member of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, Livingston McLean. While some people kill family members for revenge against someone else for a perceived slight or injury, I would just caution people not to rush to judgment in this matter, said Cashin, adding, I encourage everyone in our community to not express conjecture on Facebook or other social media. O'Connor also advised judicious use of social media. Wait for all the facts to come out before assuming that what you read is true, she said. Instead, spend the time engaging in self-care, such as exercise, creative pursuits, and meditation or prayer. Sometimes, bad things occur without warning, Cashin noted. But warning signs that a person may be contemplating suicide include talking or writing about it, looking for means of dying by suicide, expressing hopelessness, or feeling trapped, substance abuse, a change in mood, especially agitation, saying goodbye and becoming isolated from family and friends. Warning signs of someone contemplating homicide can include suicide warning signs or someone threatening harm, including against someone that he or she is attempting to control, mental health professionals said. While psychosis, such as hearing things no one else can hear, also can be a warning sign, most people with mental illness are not violent, O'Connor said. Very few aggressive people become homicidal, Cashin cautioned. Homicide itself is difficult to predict. If you or someone you know is experiencing any of these warning signs, talk with the person, listen to them, call 911 or PATH 211 or the Center for Human Services 309-827-5351, which may call the CHS crisis team and refer to longer-term counseling through agencies, some of which provide services without charge or on a sliding scale. Some employers also have employee assistance programs that can refer people to counseling. For young children grappling with the news, O'Connor advised telling them, just like people can get sick in their body, they can get sick in their minds. Sometimes when people get sick in their minds, they are in a great deal of pain and can see no other choice but to leave the world. Even though they may feel that way, there are always options, like talking to friends and family. Just like with the flu, we can get better if we take our medicine, talk with someone, and take care of ourselves. For teenagers and adults trying to make sense of the tragedy, Cashin recommends listening to them and keeping in touch, but said she has no problem admitting that he has no idea how a tragedy like this can happen. But I would tell them we need to be kind to each other and love one another, even more now than before. And our next story is entitled, Security Cameras Playing a Role in Probes. When Bloomington police began investigating the deaths of two children and the apparent suicide of their family early Tuesday, they had a tool to assist them with details of what happened. Footage from a home security system that showed the father hiding cell phones in a kitchen cabinet. The expanding use of interior security cameras is helping to catch a growing number of criminals and providing law enforcement with valuable evidence that's used to solve crimes. In the case of the death of Eric Ringenberg, 33, and his killing of his sons, and one an infant son and 1 2-year-old, Bloomington police used the video to confirm Ringenberg's role in the deaths, said Assistant Police Chief Clay Wheeler. All three were found in the basement of the family home at 14 Brittany Court in Bloomington. The cause of death was strangulation by ligature, according to McLean County Coroner's Office. A home video also captured a break-in last year at the home of a Bloomington couple who were robbed at gunpoint. In that case, the footage played for a jury in the recent trial of Isaiah Miller showed three men forcing their way into the home and ordering the couple onto the kitchen floor. Miller, 20, of Bloomington, was convicted of home invasion. Charges are pending against co-defendant Kendrick Cooley and a third suspect that has not been arrested. Home security systems are becoming more popular with young homeowners who realize that sometimes bad things can happen when they're at home as well as when they're away, said Bill Haney, one of the owners of Young Security Systems in Springfield, a company that also serves McLean County customers. "We're putting cameras in more frequently than even a year ago," said Haney. "Security cameras have become more sophisticated, offering higher quality video for a lower cost. Both attractive features for 20 to 30-year-old residents," said Haney. "For some people, interior cameras are part of a larger home security system that includes exterior video recorders and alarms." Robert Brown, owner of Rockstar Audio Visual and Integrated Security in Normal, said customers often purchase home video system monitors to monitor child care and house cleaning staff in addition to personal security. Others are looking for a way to keep an eye on pets while they're away. "When crime reports are up, sales also spike," said Brown. "We see the security systems go up when there are more burglaries," he said. "What's captured on security cameras outside a home also can be helpful to authorities." Bloomington police asked for the public's help in November 2014 with its investigation of the death of Pam Zimmerman and after several of her personal items were found several blocks from the East Side office complex where she was fatally shot. Police reviewed a large amount of footage from homes and businesses in their effort to collect evidence that the victim's ex-husband, Kirk Zimmerman, may have been in the area around the time of her death. Normal police have used still photos from exterior security systems to circulate images of potential suspects in other cases, said Assistant Police Chief Eric Klingel. In one case, a homeowner was able to provide a photo of the vehicle that crashed into his tree and left deep ridges in his lawn, said Klingel. "He had a clear video of the car showing it lost control and hit the tree," said Klingel. Normal has installed security cameras in its uptown area, but to date the footage has not been used to solve a crime. Moving on to another article entitled, "Bloomington Normal Man Faces Added Charges. Driver in Fatal Crash 2015 Home Invasion Has Multiple Charges." The driver charged in connection with a fatal September 13th traffic crash faces new charges related to a 2015 home invasion in Normal. Jacob Collins, 22, of Bloomington, was in McLean County Circuit Court on Thursday on charges of home invasion, residential burglary, armed robbery, and aggravated battery. According to a statement read in court by Assistant State's Attorney Samantha Vasquez, Collins and co-defendant Shakar Roan broke into a home in Normal in November 2015 armed with a baseball bat and with what the victim believed was a gun. The men allegedly demanded money and fled with $150. During the bond hearing held via a video link with the McLean County Jail, Collins commented that, "I'm not black," in response to a portion of the statement describing the suspects as black males. In August, Roan pleaded guilty to home invasion and was sentenced to 9 years in prison. Collins was jailed in lieu of posting $15,035 in bond on the new charges. He previously was jailed in lieu of posting $30,035 on the crash-related charges. Still pending against Collins is a charge of leaving the scene of an accident involving a death filed after his arrest on September 14th in connection with a fatal crash on Morrissey Drive and Crispin Lane. Phyllis Graver, 79, of Carmel, Indiana, was killed, and Richard Gordemiller, who was driving the sport utility vehicle in which Graver was riding, was hospitalized with what police said were not life-threatening injuries. According to police, Collins admitted that he was driving a minivan involved in the collision. During questioning, Collins confessed to the officer that he was the driver of the red van involved in the traffic crash, Assistant State's Attorney Ashley Scarborough said in court last week. Now let's take a shift to a little bit lighter story. Our next article is entitled Autumn Arrives Amid Sweltering Heat in Bloomington Normal, written by Julia Evilsizer. Today brings the official arrival of fall, but the Wilmert family hasn't put away their swimming suits just yet. Colleen Wilmert of Morton watched her daughters, Emmalyn, 3, and Lorraine, 2, as they raced through the cool water of the splash pad at Miller Park in Bloomington on Wednesday afternoon when high temperature topped 90 degrees. It would be nice if the pools stayed open later, said Wilmert. It's crazy because I know the first day of fall is this week. I'm looking forward to the weather cooling down so we can have bonfires and watch the leaves falling. But muggy weather isn't going anywhere for a few more days, said Daryl Onton, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln. We're looking at a 90-degree high for Friday, perhaps cooling just a touch to the upper 80s for the weekend, said Onton. In fact, high temperatures for the week were a few degrees shy of record highs for the area, he added. The record high for Thursday and Friday was 94 degrees, set in 1908 and 1930, respectively. Illinois State climatologist Jim Angel said the normal high this time of year in Bloomington Normal is around 77 degrees. That's a big difference, said Angel. Usually, by mid-September, we're starting to see some not-so-hot days and cool nights. August felt more like September, and September's feeling more like August. Warm temperatures will stick around for the first half of next week, too, said Angel, hovering in the mid-80s before dropping down to normal temperatures in the 70s by the end of the week. The newest long-term forecast shows us that Illinois has an increased chance of a dry October, said Angel. They also indicated that we have an increased chance of a warm October, November, and December. Could this be the last major heat wave of the year? Never say never when it comes to Illinois weather, said Angel. We've seen 90-degree weather into October before, though it's much harder to maintain that heat the further you get into fall. The days start getting shorter, so the sun isn't quite as high in the sky, and it can't maintain the heat. Meanwhile, the Twin Cities were quenched Monday night with 1.43 inches of rain, according to NWS, but chances for showers won't return to the area until Tuesday evening. Angel said a dry, hot September doesn't hurt soybean and corn crops, but can affect when leaves begin to change. If you ask farmers, they'll say more rain doesn't help much at this point since the crops are almost ready to harvest. Additional rain could even hinder them by making the fields too wet to get tractors out. A bigger concern, he said, is farmers trying to establish cover crops like winter wheat or to maintain pasture land. For homeowners, it's the same story, said Angel. The lack of rain won't matter too much for your lawn or garden at this point in the year. The fringe of some trees in the pantograph area have already begun to change color and dropping leaves. If trees are under stress, the leaves will turn brown and fall off. We haven't had a good recipe for a colorful fall, said Angel. Expect to see the heat ease up soon, and we'll get back to somewhat normal weather after this hot bump in the road. And next up, we have a little bit of news out of Illinois State University with an article entitled President Dietz Shares Future Plans for University, written by Julia Evilsizer. Illinois State University President Larry Dietz on Thursday thanked students and faculty for enduring 2 years without a state budget and shared plans for the future of the university. Dietz delivered his annual State of the University message to an audience of nearly 400 at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts. The past 2 years of political and fiscal gridlock have taken a harsh toll on all of us who work in Illinois' colleges, he said. The constant barrage of partisan finger-pointing and delaying tactics acted as a daily stressor. However, Dietz said, entering a new semester with full state funding for the first time in 3 years brings a brief but welcome sigh of relief. ISU's state operating appropriation for fiscal year 2018 is just over $65 million, said Dietz, $7.2 million less than pre-impasse fiscal year 2015 budget. He said ISU received $20.9 million from the state in 2016, and that the last time the state's appropriation dropped that low was during the 1960s. In the 4 years he has served at the university, Dietz said he has not once asked for greater amounts of funding from Springfield. What I have respectfully requested is a measure of predictability, an effort to maintain fiscal stability, and a willingness to engage in bipartisan conversations about the future of public higher education in Illinois, said Dietz. Despite the years of uncertainty accompanying the impasse, Dietz said the university has weathered the political storm by boosting graduate enrollment, lowering debt burdens, and careful spending. With more financial security this year, Dietz said ISU will funnel $12 million to supplement monetary award program grants and additional investments to merit-based school scholarships. In addition, I have doubled the budget in a university college program that provides tools to help raise the retention and graduation rates for underrepresented first-generation and financially at-risk students, said Dietz. He said new learning opportunities for students are coming to campus, including the introduction of a cybersecurity major this fall. Dietz announced plans to establish engineering programs and online degree programs in the future. Dietz also touched on adjustments being made to the university's strategic plan that has been renamed Educate, Connect, Elevate. He said new values have been added to the plan: collaboration and respect. Collaboration shows a commitment to our internal dedication to shared governance, and respect shows that differences of belief and opinion can be expressed with civility, said Dietz. Lastly, Dietz addressed the recent launch of ISU's most ambitious fundraising campaign, Redbirds Rising, the campaign for Illinois State. More than $103 million have been raised for the campaign, with a goal of $150 million by 2020. Next, we'll move to an article entitled Court Upholds Drew Peterson Conviction. The use of hearsay testimony to convict former Chicago area police officer Drew Peterson in the death of his third wife was proper, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled Thursday in upholding the conviction. The High Court, in a unanimous decision, found that hearsay testimony from Peterson's dead third wife and missing fourth wife did not violate his constitutional right to confront his accusers because of evidence that Peterson killed them to prevent their testimony. The 63-year-old former police sergeant from the Chicago suburb of Bolingbrook is serving a 38-year sentence in the 2004 death of his ex-wife, Kathleen Savio. He'll follow that with 40 more years after a conviction last year on allegations that he plotted to kill the prosecutor who put him behind bars. Savio's body was found in a dry bathtub in 2004, weeks before a scheduled hearing to determine monetary and child custody issues related to her divorce from Peterson. Her death was initially ruled accidental, but the case was reopened after the 2007 disappearance of Peterson's fourth wife, Stacy Peterson. Savio's body was exhumed, an autopsy was conducted, and her death was ruled a homicide. Stacy Peterson is presumed dead, though her body has never been found. Drew Peterson remains a suspect in her disappearance, but he has never been charged. Prosecutors had no physical evidence tying Peterson to Savio's death, and no witnesses placing him at the scene, so they relied on hearsay, statements Savio made to her family members, and in a written statement to police before she died, and that Stacy Peterson made to her pastor and a divorce lawyer before she vanished. Hearsay is any information reported by a witness that is not based on the witness's direct knowledge. The Illinois court's ruling, written by Justice Margaret Thace, found proper use of hearsay, typically forbidden in criminal proceedings because it can't be challenged, under a legal doctrine of forfeiture by wrongdoing. We cannot say what the trial court's that the trial court's finding that the state provided that defendant murdered Kathleen to prevent her from testifying was unreasonable, arbitrary, or not based on the evidence presented, Thace wrote. An attorney for Peterson did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the ruling. Illinois adopted a hearsay law in 2008 tailored to Drew Peterson's case, dubbed Drew's Law, which assisted in making some of the evidence admissible. And the next story is entitled Evaluation for Mattoon Suspect. The Mattoon High School student accused of shooting another student at the school Wednesday was ordered in his first court appearance Thursday to undergo psychological evaluations. Circuit Judge Mitchell Schick granted requests for the evaluations from Coles County Public Defender Anthony Ortega, who's been appointed to represent the high school freshman charged as a juvenile with aggravated battery with a firearm. The court does not permit the identification of juvenile suspects. Schick appointed Dr. Lawrence Jekyll, a Champaign psychiatrist, to examine the teen, who will remain in a state juvenile detention facility. The evaluation will address the teen's mental condition at the time of the shooting and whether he's able to understand and help with his legal defense, whether he is at risk to himself or others, and the possible need for treatment while the case remains underway will also be assessed. Coles County State's Attorney Brian Bauer didn't object to Schick's order for the evaluations. The boy's parents attended the hearing and responded to Schick's question, said they agreed to the evaluations. Members of the boy's family declined to be interviewed for this story. The shooting took place late in the morning in the school's cafeteria. Some sources have indicated that bullying was a motivation. While addressing the detention issue Thursday, Bauer provided Schick with some of the details of the Mattoon Police Department's investigation. He said witnesses whom Police Lieutenant Detective Sam Gaines interviewed included a high school student who said she was sitting at the lunch table with the suspect and other students. The girl said she saw the boy had a gun, and physical education teacher Angie McQueen approached him, Bauer said. The boy then pulled the gun and pointed it at the girl and fired as McQueen grabbed his arm, he said. The shot missed the girl but hit another student in the upper chest, Bauer said. More shots were fired into the cafeteria's ceiling before McQueen subdued the boy, he said. In addition, a semi-automatic handgun was later found in the teen's possession, Bauer said. Authorities have identified the wounded student as a boy who was hospitalized in stable condition. A conviction would mean the suspect could be held by the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice until the age of 21. Schick scheduled his next court appearance for October 5th. Mattoon High School again will operate on an early dismissal schedule Friday, ending classes at 12:09 p.m., according to school officials. And let's shift focus for a second to a little bit of national news, with an article entitled, Trump, U.S. Beef Up North Korea Sanctions. President Donald Trump added economic actions to his fiery military threats against North Korea on Thursday, authorizing stiffer new sanctions in response to the Koreans' nuclear weapons advances. Its leader, Kim Jong-un, issued a rare statement branding Trump as deranged and warning that he will pay dearly for his threat to totally destroy the North if it attacks. The exchange of superheated rhetoric and unusually personal abuse between the adversaries will escalate tensions that have been mounting as North Korea has marched closer to achieving a nuclear-tipped missile that could strike America. The crisis has dominated the Trump's debut at this week's annual UN General Assembly meeting. Kim's statement, carried by North Korea's official news agency in a dispatch from Pyongyang earlier this Friday, responded to Trump's combative speech days earlier, where he not only issued the warning of political obliteration for the isolated nation, but also mocked the North's young autocrat as a rocket man on a suicide mission. Kim offered choice insults of his own. He said Trump was unfit to hold the prerogative of supreme command of his country. He described the president as a rogue and a gangster fond of playing with fire. He characterized Trump's speech to the world body on Tuesday as mentally deranged behavior. I will make the man holding the prerogative of the supreme command in the U.S. pay dearly for his speech calling for totally destroying the DPRK, said the statement carried by Korean Central News Agency. DPRK is the abbreviation of the communist country's official name, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. There was no immediate response from the White House. On Thursday in New York, Trump announced the latest steps to punish foreign companies that deal with the North. It was the latest salvo in a U.S.-led campaign to isolate and impoverish Kim's government until it halts the missile and nuclear tests. He announced the measures as he met leaders from South Korea and Japan, the nations most immediately imperiled by North Korea's threats of a military strike. North Korea's nuclear weapons and missile development is a grave threat to peace and security in our world, and it is unacceptable that others financially support this criminal rogue regime, Trump said as he joined Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and South Korean President Moon Jae-in for his lunch. Tolerance for this disgraceful practice must end now. His executive order expanded the Treasury Department's ability to target anyone conducting significant trade in goods, services, or technology with North Korea, and to ban them from interacting with the U.S. financial system. Foreign financial institutions must choose between doing business with the United States or facilitating trade with North Korea or its designated supporters, the order says. It also issues a 180-day ban on vessels and aircraft that had visited North Korea from visiting the United States. Trump also said China was imposing major bank sanctions too, but there was no immediate confirmation from the North's most important trading partner. And we'll finish up today with a small update on how Puerto Rico is doing after Hurricane Maria, with an article entitled "Puerto Rico Faces Weeks Without Electricity." The sky was darkening Thursday afternoon as 10-year-old Sarah Jimenez laid out three plastic buckets on her grandmother's patio in hopes of capturing rainwater. "We can use it to at least flush the toilet," she told her grandmother. A day after Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico, flooding towns, crushing homes, and killing at least two people, millions of people on the island faced the dispiriting prospect of weeks and perhaps months without electricity. The storm knocked out the entire grid across the U.S. territory of 3.4 million, leaving many without power to light their homes, cook, pump water, or run fans, air conditioners, or refrigerators. As a result, Jimenez and others hunted for gas canisters for food cooking, collected rainwater, or steeled themselves mentally for the hardships to come in the tropical heat. Some contemplated leaving the island. "You cannot live here without power," said Hector Llanos, a 78-year-old retired New York police officer who planned to leave Saturday for the U.S. mainland to live there temporarily. Like many Puerto Ricans, Llanos does not have a generator or gas stove. "The only thing I have is a flashlight," he said, shaking his head. "This is never going to return to normal." Maria's death toll across the Caribbean, meanwhile, climbed to at least 19, nearly all of them on the hard-hit island of Dominica. In Puerto Rico, the government said at least two were killed, but media on the island were reporting additional deaths, and the actual death toll appeared unlikely to be known for days. As of Thursday evening, Maria was moving to the northern coast of the Dominican Republic with winds of 120 miles per hour. The storm was expected to approach the Turks and Caicos Islands in the Bahamas late Thursday and early Friday. From there, it's expected to veer into the open Atlantic, no threat to the U.S. mainland. In Puerto Rico, the grid was in sorry shape long before Maria, and Hurricane Irma 2 weeks ago struck. The territory's $73 billion debt crisis has left agencies like the state's power company broke. It abandoned most basic maintenance in recent years, leaving the island subject to regular blackouts. "We knew this was going to happen, given the vulnerable infrastructure," Governor Ricardo Rossello said. Federal emergency management agencies said it would open an air bridge from the mainland on Friday, with 3 to 4 military planes flying to the island every day carrying water, food, generators, and temporary shelters. "There's a humanitarian emergency here in Puerto Rico," Rossello said. "This is an event without precedent." He said his administration was trying to open ports soon to receive shipments of food, water, generators, cots, and other supplies. That's going to wrap up the first section of news from the Pantgraph today. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with the second half from news dated Friday, September 22nd. My name is Matt Woodbury. Thank you. Matt Woodbury. Thank you.